Right now, somewhere out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, there is a single corrugated steel box just getting completely battered by 40-foot waves.
Yeah, just relentless wind, salt water spraying everywhere across the deck of this massive ship.
Exactly. And inside that box is, your brand new television.
Which is honestly a wild thing to picture.
Right. But the truly remarkable thing isn't just that the TV is going to survive the storm. It's that in a few weeks, that exact same television will be sitting on your front porch in pristine condition.
Yeah, and throughout a journey of like over 6,000 miles, not a single human hand will have ever touched the actual product.
It's all thanks to this massive invisible system called intermodal freight. And whether your package arrives early or late, its entire journey depends on a beautifully simple concept.
Yeah, intermodal basically just means moving a single sealed unit, which is usually a large metal container, across multiple modes of transport.
Right, so you go from a ship to a train to a truck.
Exactly. And the absolute golden rule of this whole system is that the cargo inside is never handled. You load the box once at the factory, you unload it once at the destination, and everything in between is just about moving the metal box itself.
I always like to think of it like a massive global relay race. So the container is the baton, right?
That's a great way to look at it.
And the runners in this race, the cargo ships, the freight trains, the semi trucks, they just seamlessly pass that baton along without ever opening it or looking inside.
Because a massive port crane doesn't actually care if the box is full of expensive sneakers or auto parts. It just lifts a box.
So our mission for this deep dive is to unpack exactly how this invisible choreography works. We are going to follow a single metal container all the way across the world and explain why this specific method of moving things is basically the secret backbone of the global economy.
I promise you, you will never look at a truck on the highway the same way again.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
But to really appreciate how seamless the modern system is, we have to talk about how chaotic things used to be.
Oh, it was a mess. Before these standardized containers existed, we relied on a system called break bulk shipping.
Break bulk. I mean, that just sounds like doing everything the hardest possible way.
It really was. It was so incredibly labor intensive. Imagine a dock back in, say, the 1950s. Every single wooden crate, every barrel of oil, every sack of coffee had to be loaded into the hull of a ship individually,
By hand.
by hand, by massive teams of longshoremen. A ship could sit in port for weeks just taking on cargo.
Wow.
And because the cargo was loose, it was constantly shifting around, is frequently damaged, delayed, and wildly susceptible to theft.
But then things changed in 1956, right? April 26, to be exact.
Right. A trucking entrepreneur named Malcolm McLean takes a converted tanker ship called the Ideal X, and he sails it out of New Jersey with 58 containers on board.
So he just took the truck bodies off their wheels and stacked them on the deck.
Basically, yeah. And that voyage is widely considered the birth of modern containerization.
Okay, but I have to push back a little on the mythology here. I mean, a corrugated metal box isn't exactly a technological marvel, you know? Humans have been putting things in boxes for millennia. What is the actual magic trick here?
Well, you're right. The true genius wasn't the box itself. The real revolution was interoperability. And that came down to a brilliant piece of engineering by a man named Keith Tantlinger.
Okay, what did he do?
He designed something called the corner casting and the twist lock.
Let's try to visualize this for everyone listening. How does this lock actually work?
So at each of the eight corners of a modern shipping container, there's a heavy cast steel fitting with a distinct oval hole in it. That's the corner casting.
Got it. Eight corners, eight oval holes.
Exactly. And the twist lock is a simple cone-shaped device on whatever equipment is moving the box. It drops into that oval hole and rotates a quarter turn to lock securely into place.
Just a quarter turn.
Just a quarter turn. It eventually became a global standard known as ISO 1161. That one humble little fitting allows a crane to lift the box from above. It lets the box lock to a truck chassis from below.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and it lets it lock to a ship's deck and even lock to the container stacked immediately beneath it.
So you get lifting, stacking, securing, and lashing all from that one simple quarter turn mechanism at the corners.
That quarter turn is basically the entire ball game. And crucially, in the late 1960s, Malcolm McLean's company actually agreed to release the patents for that corner fitting royalty-free.
Wait, they just gave it away.
They did. By giving away the patent, they allowed the entire global logistics industry to standardize around one universal design.
That is wild. And the economic shockwave of that standardization is profound. I mean, in 1956, loading loose breakbulk freight onto a ship cost roughly $5.80 per ton.
Right.
But once the container and the twist lock became the standard, that cost dropped to about 16 cents per ton. 16 cents? I mean, when transportation costs fall by well over 90%, you don't just ship the same goods a little more cheaply. You completely reorganize the geography of manufacturing.
Right, because suddenly it's mathematically viable to spread supply chains across oceans.
Exactly. It's the quiet reason why a company can, say, manufacture parts in one hemisphere, assemble them in another, and then sell them in a third.
Because it became so incredibly cheap to move goods, it just triggered an explosion in global trade, which is why you always hear people casually throw around that claim, you know, that 90% of everything moves in containers.
Ah, yeah, that catchy slogan.
Right. But I want to clear that up for you listening, because it's actually unverified folklore. It traces back to a book title rather than hard data. The actual verified numbers from the UN report that over 80% of world merchandise trade by volume moves by sea.
Which is still massive. It is. And the great majority of those manufactured finished goods travel in containers. So it's not quite 90% of literally everything. But if you buy a finished product that crossed an ocean, it almost certainly rode in one of these boxes.
And you know, the hardware gets even more fascinating when you realize there isn't just one type of container. We actually operate with two distinct worlds of boxes, and they sort of meet at the seaport.
Okay, let's break this down. First is the ocean box, right?
Right, the international container. These are built to that global ISO standard we talk about. Heavy, rigid steel, built to survive brutal ocean storms and to be stacked many layers deep inside the hull of a ship. They generally come in 20-foot and 40-foot lengths.
And the industry measures volume based on those sizes using a metric called TEU, which stands for 20-foot equivalent unit.
Yep. So a 20-foot box is one TEU.
And a 40-foot box is two TEU. But wait, I see trucks on the highway all the time, and those boxes look way bigger than 40 feet. What's going on inland?
Yeah. Inland North America runs on a completely different standard. We use the domestic container, which is 53 feet long.
Why 53 specifically?
It's actually very straightforward logic. 53 feet perfectly matches the largest trailer legally allowed on U.S. interstates.
Well, that makes sense.
Right. By maximizing that length, a domestic container holds up to 26 standard pallets on the floor. Compare that to a 40-foot ocean box, which only holds about 20 or 21 pallets.
But that creates an interesting puzzle. I mean, if the electronics come over from Asia in a 40-foot ocean box, but they need to move inland to Ohio in a 53-foot domestic box, somebody has to physically move the goods between them.
Yeah, that process is called transloading. Near the port, the cargo is physically unloaded from the international boxes and shifted into domestic ones. Usually, they consolidate the cargo from three 40-foot ocean boxes into just two 53-foot domestic boxes.
Three ocean boxes into two domestic boxes? But honestly, why go through all the labor of manually moving thousands of boxes of TVs? Doesn't paying warehouse workers to shift cargo kind of defeat the entire never-touch-the-goods rule?
It definitely sounds counterintuitive, but the math strongly favors transloading for long inland moves. It generally cuts the inland transportation cost by roughly 30%.
Wait, 30% just by combining them?
Yeah, because think about the mechanics. Moving three ocean containers to Chicago requires three separate truck cabs, three drivers, and three rail slots. If you consolidate into two 53-foot boxes, you only pay for two drivers and two rail slots.
Oh, wow. That adds up fast.
And furthermore, those heavy ocean containers belong to the maritime shipping companies. If you take their box all the way to Chicago, you're paying a daily rental fee for the chassis it sits on.
And they want their box back, I assume.
Oh, they want it back quickly. Transloading empties the ocean box right at the port so it can go immediately back onto a ship.
Got it. Now, once those 53-foot domestic boxes hit the rail network, how do they actually ride?
Well, the older method is called TOFC, or trailer on flat car. This is essentially piggybacking. They literally lift an entire highway, trailer rubber tires, and all directly onto a rail car.
But that's not the main way anymore, right?
No, the modern norm is COFC, or container on flat car. So only the container body itself rides on the train, without any wheels attached. Today, the U.S. intermodal mix is split almost down the middle. As of late 2025, it was about 51% international ocean boxes moving inland and 48% domestic 53-foot boxes.
Okay, let's slow the pace down for a second and bring all this theory into reality. Let's actually trace the epic journey of one specific shipment of televisions, starting at a factory in Asia and heading to a distribution center on the U.S. East Coast.
Let's do it. So step one, the journey begins the moment the goods are packed and the steel doors are sealed shut in Asia. Nobody touches the TVs until they reach the final buyer.
Step two is getting that heavy box to the water. This introduces a crucial vocabulary word, drayage.
Right, drayage. It's just the short-haul truck move. Think of it as the connective tissue between the different modes. A grayage truck takes the box to the port.
And then steps three and four, the ocean voyage. Massive cranes load the box onto a ship operated by global ocean carrier alliances. The ship crosses the Pacific and arrives at San Pedro Bay in Southern California,
which is home to the ports of LA and Long Beach. The volume there is insane. In 2024, LA handled about 10.3 million TEU, and Long Beach handled about 9.6 million.
Millions of boxes. Just hard to comprehend. So step five, the ship docks and our box is discharged. A terminal operator lifts it ashore, and the moment it touches the ground, a very expensive ticking clock starts.
Yeah, this is where we talk about free time and demurrage. The terminal provides a small window of free time to let the box sit. If it overstays, the owner gets hit with demurrage, which is a really harsh financial penalty.
Basically a massive fine for taking up space.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because space at a port is finite. Any idle time, which the industry calls dwell, is the enemy of the whole system.
So to avoid demurrage, steps six and seven kick in. A truck grabs the box and moves it to a rail yard, which is known as the ramp. Here, it gets loaded onto a well car.
Right. A well car is a rail car with a recessed center. The container sits incredibly low, which lowers the center of gravity and leaves enough vertical clearance to actually stack a second container right on top of it.
No, I have to stop you there. Stacking them too high obviously saves a massive amount of money, but wouldn't a train that tall just completely smash into highway bridges? You're talking about like 18 feet of vertical clearance.
Yeah, that was a massive infrastructure hurdle. It's called double stacking, and it was introduced back in 1984. To make it work, the railroad basically had to physically reshape the country.
What do you mean?
They spent decades and billions of dollars blasting old mountain tunnels to make them taller, raising highway bridges, and physically lowering rail tracks.
Just to fit the top box.
Just for the top box. But it slashed costs so much that today, nearly 70% of U.S. intermodal moves double stacked.
That brings us to step eight, the line haul. This is the long journey across the country, handled by the Class I railroads. There are six of these heavy lifters in North America, and they are fast. A premium service train can shoot a box from LA to Chicago in about 3 to 4 days.
Which is incredible speed.
Yeah.
And then steps 9 and 10, destination. The box arrives in Chicago, gets lifted off the train, and a final drayage truck takes it those last few miles to the actual retailer.
The seal is broken and the TVs are unloaded for the very first time. But you know what fascinates me? The retailer in Ohio didn't call a trucker in Asia, an ocean line, a drayage driver in LA, and a railroad all separately to arrange this.
No, that would be an absolute nightmare.
Right, so who actually organized all of this?
There's an invisible middleman called an IMC, or Intermodal Marketing Company. Mm. See, railroads only want to sell wholesale train capacity. They don't want to talk to individual retailers.
Makes sense.
So the IMC steps in, buys that rail space, arranges the drayage, rents the chassis, the wheeled frame the box sits on, and basically gives the retailer one simple door-to-door ticket.
Okay, so the TVs are delivered, but now we have a huge problem. We're left with a giant, empty, 53-foot metal box sitting in the Midwest.
Yes, the empty box dilemma. It's a massive headache.
And it's driven by an imbalance, right? Because yeah. North America imports far more containers than it exports.
Exactly. So empties just pile up in the U.S., while factories in Asia are constantly running short.
That sounds like paying for a taxi to drive all the way across town, dropping you off, and then paying the driver to drive all the way back completely empty just to return the car.
It is exactly like that. The carriers spend fortunes just shipping empty boxes back. Roughly 1 in 3 container moves is just an empty repositioning leg.
Wow, 1 in 3. So how do they fix it?
They use a few workarounds. One is called a street turn. So instead of driving an empty box from a warehouse all the way back to the rail hub, they take it directly to a nearby local exporter who needs a box. It saves a wasted trip.
That's smart.
They also use a penalty called detention. Kind of like demurrage at the port. Detention is the penalty you pay for keeping the box or the chassis too long at your own warehouse. It forces companies to unload fast.
To keep the whole machine moving, because the scale of this machine is just hard to fathom. The North American intermodal industry is a $55 billion business. U.S. railroads will move over 14 million units in 2025. But none of this intermodal network would exist without a massive change in 1980.
Ah, the Staggers Rail Act.
Yes, because before 1980, railroads were heavily regulated by the government. They couldn't set their own prices, they couldn't compete with trucking, and they were literally going bankrupt.
The tracks were falling apart.
Exactly. But the Staggers Act deregulated them. It gave railroads the financial freedom to act like private businesses. They could finally turn a profit and invest those billions of dollars to build this double-stacked intermodal network.
Which is huge, because shifting freight to rail is incredibly important for the future, especially when you look at efficiency and the environment.
Yeah, why does this matter for the future instead of just putting everything on highway trucks?
Fuel efficiency. A modern freight train can move one ton of goods nearly 500 miles on a single gallon of fuel.
500 miles on 1 gallon.
On 1 gallon. Because of that, shifting freight from truck to rail can cut greenhouse gas emissions by up to 75% for that long-haul portion. Plus, a single train takes hundreds of trucks off congested highways.
That's incredible. And the industry is still evolving. We're seeing a lot of nearshoring right now, with manufacturing moving closer to the U.S., particularly into Mexico. Laredo is now the busiest rail border crossing.
Yeah, and there's actually a new single-line railroad that connects Canada, the U.S., and Mexico end-to-end now.
And they're working on decarbonizing, too, testing battery electric locomotives.
Right, like Wabtec's FLX drive, which cut fuel use by over 11% in early tests. Union Pacific just ordered 20 of them. And there's new tech giving shippers real-time digital visibility of their boxes on one screen.
So bringing it all together, intermodal freight is essentially the art of moving a sealed box across the world. It seamlessly combines the cheap, long-haul efficiency of rail with the precise door-to-door reach of trucking.
All made possible by a standardized box, a brilliant little corner lock, and a massive relay race.
It is quietly the reason the modern global economy functions. So, we'll leave you with this final thought. Next time you're stuck in highway traffic and you end up next to a truck hauling a corrugated steel shipping container, don't just see a truck. Think about the invisible global ballet that specific box has been part of. The ocean storms, the giant robotic cranes, the double-stacked trains slicing across the desert night. And consider this. With the push toward battery electric trains and automated logistics, the physical internet of goods that brings everything to your door might one day operate almost entirely without a single drop of fossil fuel.